Thank you. Welcome, everyone, to the opening session of the Boston Book Festival, The Art of the Wire. The Boston Book Festival was conceived as a celebration of the power of words. Tonight, we are celebrating the art that results when brilliant writing, inspired acting, and stunning cinematography combine to create not only gripping and powerful drama, but also profound social criticism. I would like to thank the one individual who was the driving force behind making this evening happen. Jeffrey Meyerson is the owner of the Harvard Bookstore and a Boston Book Festival board member, and he was determined to bring together this brilliant group of people so that you could enjoy this evening tonight. Thank you, Jeff. And now it is a great pleasure to introduce my friend, the Reverend Eugene Rivers. Eugene knows well the hallowed halls of Harvard as well as the mean streets of Philly and Boston. Eugene co-founded the 10-Point Coalition, which is credited with putting an end to the gang violence of the 1990s, and has become a national and international model. He's the director of the Ella J. Baker House and is currently working with the Boston Police Department on a mentoring project for at-risk youth with a curriculum based on The Wire. And he tells me he is the unofficial prime minister of Wirehead Nation in Boston. So please welcome Eugene Rivers.
Good evening. We're going to get this thing popping tonight, y'all. So first, we're going to let all these folks come in and take their seats quickly. A few clips from the series, which is the best television in the history of television.
Shit, we locked up. We best not believe that, right?
He's saying that the past is always with us. And where we come from, what we go through, how we go through it, all this shit matters. I mean, that's what I thought he meant.
Go ahead.
Like at the end of the book, you know? Boats and tides and all. It's like you can change up. Right? You can say you somebody new, you can give yourself a whole new story. But what came first is who you really are. And what happened before is what really happened. And it don't matter that some fool say different, because the only thing that make you different is what you really do or what you really go through. Like, you know, like all them books in his library. Now, he fronting with all them books. But if we pull one down off the shelf, ain't none of the pages ever been open. He got all them books, and he ain't read near one of them. Gatsby, he was who he was, and he did what he did. And because he wasn't ready to get real with the story, that shit caught up to him. I mean, I think, anyway.
But I treated you like a son.
I wasn't made to play the son.
But my supply, the good dope.
The Greeks, they cool with it.
Proposition then. I just step out the way. You'll never hear from me again. I'll just disappear.
Joe, you'd be up in a mischief in no time. Truth is, you won't be able to change up any more than me. Close your eyes. It won't hurt none. There now. Joe, relax. Breathe easy.
nigga.
Damn.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like you to hold your applause until we've brought out our entire cast and participants for this evening. Our first panelist is Mr. George Pelicanos, who is one of the geniuses that contributed to producing this extraordinary art. Mr. George Pelicanos, would you join us, please? Thank you. I know y'all can't resist. Go ahead, Claude. Go ahead, y'all. I know y'all can't resist. You knew him he's the real Omar upon which the character Omar Little is based, Mr. Larry D. Andrews. Come on out, Brother Larry. And his lifelong partner, who was one of the major characters in the prequel to The Wire, Miss Fran Denise Andrews. Would you come on out, Fran? Thank you. You knew him as Pooh, the young dude who was the partner of Bodie on the corner. Ladies and gentlemen, join me in welcoming Samuel Trey Cheney. Come on out. Come on out, Pooh. And now, what one young person called the Meyer Lansky of the crew. Ladies and gentlemen, join me in welcoming Prop Joe Robert F. Chu. Come on up, Prop Joe. And finally, you knew him as Marlo Stansfield, one of the coldest dudes that we have seen on any kind of television. Ladies and gentlemen, join me in bringing out Marlo Stansfield, Jamie Hector. Let's put our hands together. Now y'all may be seated. So for the next 29 minutes or so, we're gonna mix it up with this distinguished squad. We are so thankful for y'all to make the time to come out. And I want to begin with Donnie, because I've got to ask this question. In the video clip that we saw, Omar jumps out of a third to four story apartment building window. Donnie, I got to ask you, dude, did that really happen?
No, they cut it. It was six.
Say a bit about that, brother.
Yeah, it was 6 4. You know, once your adrenaline get to going, and bullets get to flying around, and you don't think, you just react. And I just reacted. It just so happened it was raining, and it was like the hedges was around the projects. I landed on them and kept on going.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. Plus, I had my gun in my belt. I forgot I had it. That's how it happens sometimes.
Okay, next question to Donnie and Fran. David Simon and Ed Burns created two television series, The Corner and The Wire, in part on your lives. How did that happen, and what do you think drew David and Ed to your particular stories, both of y'all? Fran, what you think?
You say, how did they...
How were they drawn to you? What was it about y'all that drew them?
Well, I don't think David and Ed knew that Donnie and I was going to end up together. When they were making The Corner, they were trying to get a lot of information from me that they couldn't get. And one day they just told me that they had somebody that was time enough for me, which was supposed to be Donnie.
Right.
So me and Donnie just met by Ed giving him my phone number. And that one phone number lasted 18 years. So nobody never thought that. we didn't think that we would even be a couple, you know, but things happened, and first we just became friends, and over the years, you know, feelings just set in. And I didn't think it would happen either, because I was one of those people that never could understand how a woman could wait for a man that's in prison. You know, until it happened to you, you don't understand. So we've been together 21 years, married 4. So,
all right,
my friend.
Okay, good for you.
And I think one of the good parts was about that was that we became friends first, you know, and in order to start any type of relationship, you know, I think you have to understand the person here, you know, before you start dealing with the body. So, and at that time, I had like...
You had no choice.
I had no choice. I was doing a life sentence with the feds and 2 life sentences with the state. So at that point in time, it was like, who knew I would be sitting here today, you know? So, and with David and how he... What happened with me and David and Ed, it was a unique situation, but, you know, because Ed, he just asked me one day, he said, you look like a man that need to talk, you know. How would you like a second chance at life? And at that point, you know, who wouldn't want a second chance at life? And I had thought I had reached my epitome, where as though I was like done. You know, I done, you know, did everything that Satan did and worse, you know, and was given this opportunity, you know, so I grabbed on. So that's how I got with David. Now, I didn't let go, you know. I had to learn, you know, because I don't believe in rehabilitation. I use the word called rehabilitate, where as though you have to readjust your whole being, your whole soul, your whole way of thinking, living, and everything. So you know, I came out of prison. I was lucky to have people like George and the crew that I could steal from, you know. George, the writer, he know they steal a lot.
Writers?
So I had to steal from them, you know, in order to make the person that I'm evolving into today, you know. So that's how I got with David.
Okay,
I wouldn't let go.
All right. Jamie.
Hey.
Your character, Marlo Stansfield. I'm originally from Philadelphia and came up on the rough side of the mountain, but I gotta say that your man Marlo is the coldest dude I think I have ever seen in life. I mean, pure evil. One of the things that made him so scary, and that scene, y'all gotta give him credit, that scene where you take out Prop Joe in the dialogue and the stare is terrifying. I mean, that's a terrifying image. I mean, you walk away with a scary thought that this is not a dude you want to see on a sunny day, right? could you help us get a better sense, because we don't know a lot about the history of an individual that evolves into that kind of evil. Give us some background and context as you imagined playing the role of Marlo Stansfield.
Well,
you know, working on this character, I had an opportunity to work on backstories, like basically create my own backstory. And the funny thing about it is, I started on Hawaii on the third season, and the kids came on the fourth season, and I had a conversation with Ed Burns, and he basically told me what he was developing for the character of Michael. And his history that you've seen developed on the screen is similar to what I wrote, a child neglected, being raised by parents that were absent, being raised by elders, seeing his mother probably on some substance that was controlling her, right? And just being trained by the streets. But at the same time, you know, being that it's also crafting, just basically going to the old neighborhood and studying the behavior patterns of dudes that I know also, you know, the way they move, the way they think, because even though Marlo to you is considered pure evil, to him he's not considered pure evil. Mm-hmm. So he justified everything he did by basically trying to attain that power and trying to be who he felt he was supposed to be based on his upbringing, right? So the music that I use, the books that I've decided to read, like certain chapters from certain books, music, some songs from Eminem, some songs from 50 Cent, some songs from Nasir Jones. He had a song called Silent Murder. And I would play that over and over again also. And just basically the methods of going about preparing for the scene, because for us, fortunately, we got the scenes maybe like a week in advance, but we didn't know what was going to happen in the next episode. So we were able to work on whatever material that we got. And, you know, Ed and David and George, they also gave me some insight on what was going to happen later on down the line so I could work on it from there. But the backstory was really the way that I created the character. I just crafted that character because I had fun with it. And just, you know, when they hired me also, they basically said, you got what it takes. So, you know, that boosted me a little bit also.
Okay. All right. As a clergyman in my vocation, we are concerned in the course of executing our duties, the idea of redemption, the possibility that folk can, at various stages in their lives, live very confused and jacked up existences, but as long as they're alive, there's a possibility that they can transcend, you know, difficulties, adversity, and and bad periods of their life. Trey, when you think about the issue of, because you get out of the game, right, and, you know, make your moves, and do you think that the series was too pessimistic, or were there any possibilities as you reflected on the series of redemption? And I'd like any of y'all to jump in on that. Feel free, but I'd like to start with you. This idea, because you've got this coldly realistic, and the thing I love about The Wire is that it was so real. That was, you know, that was the realest thing I had seen on the tube, you know, that reflected the lives that I see in young people in Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan.
Well, I guess for my character, you know, I was on it from first season through fifth season, so I'm considered like the last man standing. They went on to work, you know, in Foot Locker, but I guess taken from what the character Pook had been through.
Right.
You know, first season it was the situation where me and Bodie had that scene where actually we had to kill our best friend, which was Wallace. And I remember David Simon explaining to me the type of, you know, character that I had to get into for that. It was like when Bodie shot him, I guess me finishing him was taking him out of his misery,
right?
You know, because I didn't want to see him suffer like an animal and just, you know, just die like that. So I guess going through that, and then of course in fourth season when my right hand man Bodie was killed, it just all summed up to when Dookie walked in that Foot Locker and was like, I need some help. But at the same time, you know, everything that Poot had been through, it was like, all right, well, you got to go out there and slang a little bit more before you can, you know, get in this type of position. So, you know, I guess it was just a roundabout character that that young people go through each and every day.
Any other thoughts from any of the panelists?
Well, yes, we had this character, Cuddy, that I sort of brought in. And he was a guy who came out of prison and you know, he had the temptations and so on. But he ended up opening a boxing gym for kids in the city. And yes. This is a character that you saw come, you know, through the darkness and out into the light. And so we tried to, you know, we tried to give the full representation of people in the city just trying to make it and struggles and so on. And he was the guy, in addition to Trey's character, that you saw at the end that had a positive sort of outcome.
Sure. Given the realities that you all have lived, do you think that, because some critics have said this, that the show was too pessimistic? What are your thoughts on that?
I think it was like watered down.
That's deep, dude. Break that down, dude.
I mean, considering now what HBO is showing, you know, with the Spartacus and the Games of Thrones and the stuff they're doing, you know, we couldn't do that on the wire. We couldn't bring the actual, you know, what actually happened. You know, say like the poop, you know, like, you know, we had a guy, you know, speaking of redemption, we had a guy that we used to take care of, who raised his five kids after his mother died. And he later became the, we wouldn't let him hustle in the neighborhood. We did, you know, we took care of him. And he later became a senator for the state of Maryland and head of the NAACP. So, you know, it's not like, it's a different world from y'all side of the tracks to ours, but people is human too. And we often close our eyes to reality, you know, and say, well, I see it, but I don't see it. But it's there, and it's going to stay there, you know. So, but, yeah, we have a lot, and I'm dealing with a kid now, you know. I can't report him to the welfare because they're going to take and split the family up. So what we're doing is we're taking care of the family now. This is what we have to do in our neighborhood, you know. So it's the redemption. I'm a prime example for redemption, you know. I mean, you can take anything and turn it around once that person sees something concrete and that's justified, you know. And but once you release the hate, see, we grow up with so much hate, you know. And once I met people who taught me how to love, the situation changed. So that's where redemption comes from.
And see, what's fascinating to me is that as I met Jamie and Donnie and others, that especially I have to say Jamie, right? Because I fall in love with Jamie because, like, that's it. That's what's happening. And then I find out that the Jamie in real life is a man of faith, and that the idea of redemption he understood from how he came up. And so what was, you know, interesting and intriguing, you know, you have this cold realism, and then you have the case of Naaman, right, who gets pulled out, and when the folk talk about the pessimism, was it the captain? What's her, somebody give me the
captain. Bob Wisdom.
Right, thank you, all right. He snatches up Naaman, and Naaman's life is transformed. So when folk talk about there are no good characters, you have this amazing experience in the case of Naaman, right, who gives that brilliant presentation, as some of you will recall, in the junior high school, where he talks about AIDS and the AIDS epidemic in the world. And so it, which brings me to another question. One of the controversial aspects of The Wire has been the idea that it has reinforced stereotypes. My wife, Jacqueline Rivers, and I were in a debate with Ishmael Reed on the pages of the Boston Globe, where the title was, "Should Harvard Teach The Wire?" And Ishmael Reed says it was cliches and racist stereotypes. I'd like to get responses from all of you on that. Robert?
I'd have to disagree with that, simply because the cast of actors on the show were of a caliber of excellence, bringing those fantastic writers' work to life.
Absolutely.
There was no, and I love this actor, there was no J.J. Walkers, there was no George Jeffersons, and I respect those actors, but these actors here were the real deal. And you will find people like that in all walks of life. I was doing an interview with some paper. Yeah, I'm sorry, I forgot the name of it. And he asked me, did I think that they should teach a class on it? I said, well, yeah, because basically, what, as a human race, what we do is if it's out of sight, it's out of mind. If you don't see it, it doesn't exist. But in every city, there's an urban ghetto. And there are people like The Wire all over the United States. But everybody doesn't live in an urban ghetto. And so these realistic characters are being presented where people separate themselves so they don't really get to know where that person has come from. So some people might say it's a stereotype, but it's not. Because these were written by credible writers and they were performed by excellent writers who put the truth out there. So that's my...
So, George, obviously, you've heard that. Oh, that's good. All right. What do you think, sir?
I mean, I disagree, obviously. I wouldn't get involved in something like that.
Right.
I just wouldn't, you know.
Okay.
And I know that my colleagues, I know where their hearts are. And, you know, if you like the show, you think the show was good, then we did a good job, right?
Right. Absolutely. Well, see, my view, and I'm not here to express, but it was just simply brilliant writing. This was, you know, one of the most, right? Any other thoughts on this, on the stereotyping business? Jamie?
You know, of course I disagree also, but it's just that when you get a chance to work on the show and recognize those same individuals exist as far as all the institutions that they covered, right? I mean, I bump into detectives and federal agents on the street, and they say to me, look, it's as though you guys put a fly on a wall, because this is exactly how it really is. And you guys came the closest to it. And schools, and public schools, the Board of Education, the same thing, the professors, they say the same thing. My God, it's like you took my class, put my class on television. You hit the block in Boston. You know, when I was in New York, I mean, I never knew Boston even had an urban community that was as serious as it is, right? I come out here and dudes are telling me, look, it's the same thing that you see on the show. So I don't believe it's a stereotype. I believe it's just that the show actually captured the truth, and some people don't really want to admit that.
And my thing is, how do you stereotype reality? This is something that's happening. I knew the real Marlo. I knew the real Fat Joe. You know, poop, it's a million poops, man. You know, and so how do you stereotype reality? I mean, this is what's happening. You know, this is something that we're trying to bring forth. I mean, because as a kid, you know, so like we used to go downtown Baltimore. You know, then, you know, as we walk in, we might be about two of us. You know, we black, but we go past two white women, they grab their pocketbook. I don't snatch pocketbooks. You know, I might put a gun in your face, but I ain't gonna snatch your pocketbook.
All righty. So we'll, on that interesting note, we'll make a conceptual shift. George, The Wire is known for its use of literary devices. In fact, David Simon has called it a visual novel. What do you think he meant by this, and do you agree with the characterization?
Well, you know, that's how he pitched it to me when he brought me on board season one. And I think what he means is that, you know, it's a big story we're trying to tell. That each episode is not self-contained, it's part of this novel, and it's like a chapter in a novel. And what you can do in that format is you can stretch out, and not every scene has to advance plot. It can describe character, or it can be funny, just like life is, you know, the small moments in life that we appreciate so much. And it is like reading a book, you know, I think that's what we did, and that's how we sort of revolutionized, you know, television in a way. One thing I do want to say about the other thing is that, well, now I'm drawing a blank. What I want to say,
like we say in church, take your time.
Thank you. You can come back to me.
Okay. Well, I've got a follow-up question for you. Can you tell us about the writing process? How much of the Wire storyline was scripted from the beginning? And how did a collection of white writers manage to get so much right?
Well, we did have black writers on the show and black directors and the cast and so on. So, in fact, our friend David Mills, who passed away while we were shooting Tremé for season one, was an integral part of the team. So when we came to this thing, David had 20 years as a Baltimore crime reporter. Ed Burns was not only a Vietnam veteran, he was a cop in Baltimore, patrol and detective, and a public school teacher in Baltimore. This guy had, he had a wealth of knowledge that he brought to the table. I had been writing novels like this for 15 years at the time.
Sure.
And then we brought in people like Boston's own Dennis Lehane, Richard Price, all sorts of folks that really brought a lot to it. So, I can tell you, the white writer thing, I can just tell you that we didn't take anything lightly that we were doing. We fought it out in the writer's room every day, and every word was poured over, believe me. So, we just did the best we can.
And also, if I can tag on a note, season two, the docs was white orientated, and that was a superb season. Oh. So the writers weren't writing about black or white, they were just writing about realism in Baltimore City. Crime, police, corrupt politicians, the drug trade, the school system, it's all an integral part of what went on.
David wrote about the Marlowe's, the Prop Joe's, the Donny Andrews, for 20 years, Ed locked us up. So who got better knowledge than them?
Okay, I'm gonna tighten this up a little bit, right? Now, how would the characters, not you individually, but how would the characters living the life that you folks portrayed view Obama from the street level? Not I'm voting for him and that's the brother and keep hope alive. And no, if I use The Wire as a lens to view national politics with the same cold realism that you cats exhibited in the series.
Well, I look at Obama. I love him.
Okay, that's you here. No, I'm talking about no.
Only thing I disagree with him on is probably disagree with him on a lot of stuff. But but at the same time, what I really think he should do is he should grow a set of nuts. Because if that guy called me a baboon, I would have been knocking on his door. senator, no senator. Okay, I'm gonna show you a baboon. I'm gonna show you how we act. I love him. I'm gonna vote for him again. So
okay, so Robert.
In public, that's what I say.
Okay, Robert. Okay, you can talk okay, got it. Okay, all right. Okay, all right. I see where we're going. Okay, so Robert, if possible, how would Prop Joe view the political world?
Well, I tell you like this, right? It's the first black president. I'm gonna get a man my support, They need to give him a little time to get his feet wet. And yeah, he do need to grow a pair because he's trying to make people like him. I don't try to make nobody like me. I'm proud. No. You either like me or you out of time. So okay. The president needs to tell them people, you know what? He got his job to do. If they don't support him, they don't get behind him, how can anything change? Okay. They downsize everything he tried to do.
Okay.
So what you gonna do?
How about Poot? What would Poot say?
To be honest with you, Poot, he probably would look for answers from his other friends, like Bo. I mean, Poot would view him the same way as Prop Joe said. He's a black president, and I'm happy for him, but I'm interested in the girls. So, that's what Poot would be thinking about.
Okay, Marlo, what's happening?
You know what's happening, man?
Shoot him.
I think that he would, it would be irrelevant.
That's real. That's a real answer.
Yeah.
I got that.
You know, the truth
That's
is,
real.
It's like, look, it's all love. You made it, but if it doesn't trickle down here, I'm doing what I got to do. I'm king. I got the crown.
I love that. Yeah. That's real. That's why we love The Wire. That's right. Okay. Okay. Now.
Fran.
Hmm? Oh, somebody else? Fran?
Fran.
You fine.
That's real. That's real. You know what, Fran? I hear you. That's a real answer. All right.
That's real.
That's real. That's real. He fine. No. And he's not fine. He's fine. Right? Okay. All righty. What I'd like to do now is open it up for questions from the floor. Everybody ready? We're going to take some questions from the floor. So we want to open that up. Do we have people that will work with the microphones? And let me say this, ladies and gentlemen, we've been pretty good, and so we love you all, and we'd like you to ask a question, right? So if possible, let's have questions that, because you're all brilliant people since you live in Boston, the question will be concise and to the point. All right. So where are people? Okay, we got a microphone person, or how's that working? Oh, right here? Okay. I got to put my glasses on. Hold on. All right. Okay, here we go. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so first of all, let me say I don't watch TV. Except when my husband said I heard about this show and you should watch it, and then it became an obsession for me. And when HBO would load new episodes on, I would sit in front of the TV for like 5 hours and watch 5 episodes. And I felt like I was peering into people's lives and seeing them unfold. I would remind myself that I'm watching a piece of fiction. But as each season unfolded, I could see that what we were seeing on the show and what you're saying is real was such an endemic problem. There isn't any one thing that could change it. And so what I'm wondering is, if you're saying that this is real, and it felt real to me. I felt like Marlo was a real person, and mm-hmm. I understood how he got cold and closed off, and I could listen to Prop Joe and be like, man, that he could have done anything if he had gone to college. And so what does it, and I love Omar. I can't even tell
dear.
So my question is, what do you think would make it different? What do you think would, you were saying there's an urban ghetto in every city. What do we have to do to get rid of the ghetto? And do we want to?
Thank you. Go ahead.
My belief is family structure. Getting the family back to where it was in the 70s, and I'm not going to go too far back. For me, when the family was structured, your community was structured. There was a cooperation with law enforcement, businesses, schools, everything. The neighborhood raised you, not just your parents. And when that structure started breaking down, everything else crept in. Corruption, everything falls apart. If you build the family back up, standing strong, neighborhoods will grow back up, businesses will flourish, you'll get along with your police force, you'll want to get back into politics, you'll make sure your kids go to school, you'll try to get jobs. What starts with the family. That's for me.
All right.
Can I add on to that?
Go ahead, Jamie.
I'm going to keep it short. Just like the Reverend said, very intelligent people in here and people that probably want to make something happen and do something for the communities. Don't be afraid to come into the communities and get involved. Don't leave your day jobs, though. You know, because I can tell you, if you come into these certain communities and you do leave your day job, you might get stressed out and run back home. But if you keep your day jobs and know that you have a cushion and you can come in and you can basically be a part of the communities and help create change in the neighborhoods, then that's something that you can actually do.
All right. Sir.
Thank you for coming tonight.
Thank you.
Okay. Can we get a mic? So
we can hear. We'll repeat the question.
Okay.
My question is,
I went back to Baltimore recently. I used to live there. And I was in a record shop, and I saw a picture of members of the cast with people from the shop, and I realized, you know, when you're not shooting scenes, when you're not working on the show, you're kind of living in the area. And I just wondered if some of you could share your experiences, you know, interacting with people in Baltimore, you know, maybe someone interesting that you met, or just when you really connected with someone in the community there.
I could say, I guess like you pointed out, you know, the cast members on The Wire to me was such like a family-based cast. Like, we all like brothers and sisters, so offset, you know, connecting with certain people, like you said, at the record store. I think I know which record store you're talking about. But when you meet people and they come up to you and they say certain things like, you know, the scene where you did this or you did that, that was me. I really lived this way. And when they see that you're really not that character in real life, because Pooh, I'm nothing like Pooh in real life. So I guess when you got people coming up to you saying, man, you did an excellent job. I lived Pooh's life and this, this, and that. I guess the connection with them is just keeping it real and letting them know that this is what we captured on, you know, screen was like raw reality. And it was some realities of people's lives. So I guess the connection is just to, you know, stay in touch and keep motivating.
And we, my wife and I, Jamie has a program on Moving Mountains where he's interacting with the New York kids. And me and a friend, we have my Why Murder program. And what we're doing is a thing that Obama been preaching about since when he first ran for office is change. I'm a perfect example. Change take time, you know. And it took me, like, my first parole hearing, when I went up for my first parole hearing, I wasn't ready. You know, I wasn't ready. And I think at that point, you got to sit back and look. Change, it don't take one person. It takes the community. It takes the society to bring about change. No one person can do it. So we have to work together. So that's what we're doing with within our community right now. We're working with the young people. And we're trying to reconstruct the ghetto because there's a lot of money I'm seeing now for urban redevelopment. So that's what we're trying to concentrate on, getting people's lives back on track, you know, because Jamie said, with the Michael character, you know, if the Y you would have continued, then Michael would have been the next Omar.
That's right.
You know? That's right. So that's the way it transcends on down, generation to generation. It's like when you're in Rome, you do what the Romans do. When you're in a black community, you better do what they do. You know, so that's where it's boiled down to, you know.
Okay, madam.
Hey. I just want to say very quickly that everybody on the stage has made me cry. So, but my question for you is, what did you learn from doing this show? What do you know now that you didn't know before?
So that, is that to everyone?
Yes.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen?
For me personally, again, it was what I said earlier, out of sight, out of mind. I live in a black community, and I didn't know all this was going on. I mean, I guess I'm naive. Because I taught theater for college-bound kids in high school after after-school program for 18 years. So I stayed in the arts. And, you know, if any of you are artists out there, music, literature, dance, drama is your life, your passion. So you will stay away from anything that's not creative or constructive. And I did, and I didn't see all that. But when I was working on The Wire, and when I would meet people on the street, I started to realize, oh, wow, okay, this is more dominant in the city than I knew, because I didn't get out. I had to stop going out, because, hey, aren't you that guy? If I'm in the laundromat or the supermarket, you know, you don't want your dirty underwear. Oh, yeah, that's me, man. You know. So that was an eye-opener for me. I learned that I need to be more accessible to people, even family members, like my nephews, because most of their fathers are incarcerated and they don't have that male role model that they need, or somebody with the authority to keep them on the right path. So I got more involved in my nephew's lives and more involved with my kids in the arts lives to let them be aware of what's out there. Keeping it short.
I learned that most institutions are flawed, as well as people, you know. And like Robert said, I didn't really see it until I watched the entire 5 seasons, and I was just like, golly, the mayor in the office, you know, and then the cops, and then it's, you know, just everyone. But at the same time, there's good and there's bad, and everyone has that good and bad lining inside of them also. And no matter how innocent a person looks or how evil a person looks, you can actually pull one of those characteristics out of them.
One thing I learned was, like, first season for me, you know, the whole aspect of the wire tapping the phones. I mean, I knew about it, but I guess when I went back, I guess being in the show sometimes, you know, we so deep in it until we might not get a chance to sit back and watch the whole thing. But, like, I had some time, like, last year to just watch every season. And that first season where it got into the whole wiretapping of the phones and how the police can really, if they want to track you down, they put the wiretap in the payphone. And I mean, if you saying anything out the way or if they really trying to track you, that's how it can happen. So that was one thing that I did learn from being on the show and seeing the writing that they did.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've got about 10 minutes, so I'm going to ask you to help me because we want to try to get through that. We want to, I've been entrusted to try to keep this thing running on time. So for the next questions, if you can make them concise so we can get through them and they can respond and we can end in a timely manner. Yes, ma'am.
You talked about the urban ghetto, and most of The Wire was sort of a black-white dynamic, but a lot of urban ghettos across the U.S. now have a large Latino factor. So, like, how would you portray that in the show at all? Maybe it doesn't apply so much to Baltimore, but just if you could do another show in another city with that factor, like, how would that look?
Okay, I'll restate the question.
Yes.
What would a Latino... What would a characterization of the Latino experience look like if these folk were doing it?
Yeah, or even if Latino gangs came into The Wire from your perspective as the character, like the question he asked before, just trying to throw in, you know, a different ethnic group in there.
May I actually sort of respond to that? I'll turn it over to you. One of the things that's interesting to us, I want to give a shout out to James Dauphine, who is a young activist intellectual in town who brought The Wire to me about 5-6 years ago. And he said, yo, minister, this is it, dude. And he began working with young people. And one of the things that was interesting about the Latino piece, in Boston, in many of the poorest neighborhoods, the Latinos are black. They're Dominicans, they're Puerto Ricans, and they're black Dominicans and black Puerto Ricans. And so what was interesting at the street level is that you would show some young Puerto Ricans and Dominican dudes The Wire, and they loved it because they identified with it, because in their mind, while they were Spanish-speaking, their experience was black through a Latino lens. So that depending on which demographic within the Latino community, you get an interesting twist. Now, you know, Mexicans or a folk from the Southwest would have a different experience, but in Boston, that material was very provocative and exciting for a lot of the kids that we work with up in Dorchester. But let me just segue to you folks. Yes.
And I would also say it would have been handled extremely well, just like any other, with the writers, because they had the Russians, they had the Greeks.
Yep.
So they would have taken the Latin community and gave them just the same amount of justice. It would have been excellent.
So, but, yeah,
Baltimore doesn't have a large population of Latinos.
Yes. So we would have brought the Latin kings in.
Can I, just one thing, speaking of shout outs, Wellesley 125, Writing Plus Women, y'all out there?
All right.
I did my thing.
Okay. Good for you, George. Yes, ma'am.
All so much. It's just extraordinary. Thank you. Mr. Andrews. I'm glad you're alive. I was devastated when Omar was shot. But one of my favorite scenes when Omar was in the courtroom and he eloquently disses that slimy lawyer, Levy. And was that based on something real? It's just a wonderful moment. Did you do that?
Actually, I think it was yours.
That was just something we came up with. I don't think it was something out of Donnie's life.
Oh, really?
No.
Oh, well, it was brilliant.
No. But there's the second Stigger boys, even though I got a whole gang of lawyers on my board.
Sir.
Now we're going to try to keep it short. Trey, first of all, I love your shoes.
Thanks, man.
I had a whole gang of questions, but let's keep it short. For anyone who wants to answer this, is there any particular season that gave you any specific inspiration out of all of them that had a specific message that drove you further than all the others that really drove the message home and that made you really feel that you were doing something special on The Wire?
For me, season 4 with the kids, because I had taught, I had taught drama and coached music for 18 years with kids, and then when we got these 4 brilliant young actors and they assigned me to be the assistant drama coach for them, I would rehearse the script with them before they filmed, give them any Baltimore nuances, and they were professionals, and it was an extreme joy for me.
All right. And man,
that would, I'm sorry. That would have been mine too, season 4. And I picked season 4 because that's when I came home, 2005. And so me, Ed, and Bill Zorzi, we went to all the schools. And to go to the schools and then you have third graders, you know, you ask them, what you want to be when you grow up? And they say, well, I want to get shot. And I want to say, I want to go to prison. And then I want to say, well, I want to kill somebody. You know, that makes you, you know, want to sit back and think, you know. So I picked season four, too, because of the kids, and we was able to work with them and see them grow. You know, most of them is doing quite well. But the kids with season was very special. To everybody, I think.
Yeah. Real quick, the reason why I say season 1 is because that's kind of like where it all started. You know, it started right there in the streets of Baltimore, the Barksdales, and it was a moment for me because that was actually my first acting job ever. You know, my first audition, all of that with Pat Moran. And just to be around a loving cast, like I said, everybody was family-oriented. And towards the end of shooting, when it was getting ready to premiere, I remember one of the makeup artists, she was like, do you know what you're a part of? This is going to be big. This is going to be huge later on down the line. And I really didn't know because I didn't know anything about it. But now we're sitting here and we're, you know.
now,
so that's season 1.
Okay. So ladies and gentlemen, I can take one more question. I'm sorry.
I think this is sort of more of a writing perspective question, but if anyone else wanted to answer. I think what I really love about The Wire is what Jamie said, that you sort of see good and bad in both characters, and even when someone does something really awful, you can sort of understand where they're coming from, but I think that maybe that's a little less true of some of the women characters who are on the corner. Like, to me, the most unlikable characters are Naaman's mom or Brianna, and it seems like maybe sort of the women's motivation is a little bit left out, and I was wondering if that was just sort of a time constraint, like you could only focus on so much, or if you all had talked about women's perspective or anything like that when you were writing the show.
Well, you know, we probably didn't do as good a job with the women characters as we did with the men characters. And there was a lot of stuff that we knew it, you know, because the writers wanted to write, everybody's always fighting over the meaty scenes, right? The stuff, the violence and the funny scenes and so on. And we had women writers on the show, and what they brought to it was a little bit better than what we could bring to it. So I think, you know, I mean, not to completely agree with you. I'm not trying to, you know, like suck up to you or anything like that. But I think
Thank you.
I think you hit on something. You know, I think you're probably right. But we did have Omar's crew, those women that were with Omar, which were pretty badass, you know? I mean, they definitely...
I had one named PC Brown. She was terrible. And I think if we would have did the women, it would have been too gruesome. They more deadly than the guys. They do some stuff I wouldn't even deal with, you know? So I think that's why we stayed away. We had to turn it into a horror story or something.
Ladies and gentlemen, would you please join me? Oh, no. Was there another?
I just want to say, based on the question that the young man asked earlier on, as well as the young lady, as far as working with talent and trying to figure out how to come into the inner communities, if you want to tap in, I have an organization, non-for-profit 501c3 status, based in Brooklyn called Moving Mountains. You can find it on movingmountainsnyc.org. And basically, you can find different ways to come inside inner communities, inner city communities, and just basically give a helping hand however you can, whether it's financially or whether it's physically. You can go to the website and we could address you to how to do that. It's movingmountainsnyc.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, join me in celebrating these great artists. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Come on, y'all. These are extraordinary individuals. All right. All right.
Okay, now what do we do now?